Chapter 125, Sasura. The next day, I woke somewhat blearily. I hadn't drunk that much, but my body was no longer used to such things. And so I felt each drink three times that morning. I straggled to the baths, dunked myself in the hottest pool I could stand, then scrubbed the vaguely gritty feeling away as best I could. I was heading back to the dining hall when Vachette and Cheyenne found me in the hallway. Vachette gestured for me to follow, and I fell in step behind them. I hardly felt up for training or a formal conversation, but refusing didn't seem like a realistic option. We wound our way through several hallways, eventually emerging near the center of the school. Passing through a courtyard, we approached a small, square building that Cheyenne unlocked with a small iron key. The first locked door I had seen in all of Haert. The three of us moved into a small windowless entryway. Vachette closed the outside door, and the room grew black as pitch, cutting off the sound of the persistent wind. Then, Cheyenne opened the inner door. Warm light from a half dozen candles greeted us. At first, it seemed odd they had been left to burn in an empty room. Then, I saw what hung on the walls. Swords gleamed in the candlelight, dozens of them covering the walls. They were all of them naked, their scabbards hanging underneath them. There were no ritual trappings of the sort you might find in a Talon church, no tapestries or paintings, just the swords themselves. Still, it was obvious that this was an important place. There was a tension in the air of the sort you might feel in the archives or an old graveyard. Cheyenne turned to Vachette. Choose. Vachette looked startled by this, almost stricken. She started to make a gesture, but Cheyenne held up a hand before she could protest.
He is your student, Cheyenne said.
Refusal.
You have brought him into the school. It is your choice.
Vachette looked from Cheyenne to me, to the dozens of gleaming swords. They were all slender and deadly, each subtly different from the others. Some were curved, some longer or thicker than others. Some showed signs of much use, while some few resembled Vachette's, with worn hilts and unmarked blades of gray burnished metal. Slowly, Vachette moved to the right-hand wall. She picked up a sword, hefted it, and put it back. Then she lifted a different one, gripped it, and held it out to me. I took hold of it. It was light and thin as a whisper.
Maiden combs her hair, Vachette said.
I obeyed, feeling somewhat self-conscious as Cheyenne was watching. But before I made it halfway through the sweeping movement, Vachette was already shaking her head. She took the sword back from me and returned it to the wall. After another minute, she handed me a second sword. It had worn etching running down the blade like a crawling ivy. At Vachette's request, I made Heron Falling. I swept high and lunged low, sword flickering. Vachette raised an eyebrow to me, questioning. I shook my head. The point is too heavy for me. Vachette didn't seem particularly surprised and returned that sword to the wall as well. So things continued. Vachette hefted swords and rejected most without a word. She set three more in my hands, asked for various pieces of the katan, then returned them to the wall without asking my opinion. Vachette moved more slowly as she made her way along the second wall. She handed me a sword slightly curved like Penta's, and my breath caught when I saw the blade was the same flawless burnished gray as Vachette's. I took it carefully, but the grip wasn't right for my fingers. When I handed it back, I saw relief written plainly on her face. As she progressed along the wall, occasionally Vachette would steal a glance at Cheyenne. At those moments, she looked very little like my confident, swaggering teacher, and very much like a young woman desperately hoping for a word of advice. Cheyenne remained impassive. Eventually, Vachette came to the third wall, moving slower and slower. She handled almost every sword now, taking a long time before setting them back in their places. Then slowly, she laid her hand on another sword with a blade of burnished gray. She lifted it off the wall, gripped it, and seemed to age 10 years. Bashet avoided looking at Cheyenne and handed me the sword. The guard of this one extended out slightly, curving to give a hint of protection to the hand. It was nothing like a full handguard. Anything that bulky would render half the K-10 useless, but it looked as if it would give my fingers an extra bit of shelter, and that was appealing to me. The warm grip settled into my palm as smoothly as the neck of my lute. Before she could ask, I made Maiden combs her hair. It felt like stretching after a long, stiff sleep. I eased into 12 stones, and for the smallest of moments, I felt graceful as Pentha looked when she fought. I made Heron falling, and it was sweet and simple as a kiss. Vachette held out her hand to take it back from me. I didn't want to give it up, but I did. I knew this was the worst possible time and place for me to make a scene. Holding the sword, Vachette turned to Cheyenne. "This is the one for him," she said. And for the first time since I'd known my teacher, it was as if all the laughing had been pressed out of her. Her voice was thin and dry. Cheyenne nodded.
"I agree. You have done well to find it."
Bashette's relief was palpable, though her face still looked somewhat stricken.
"It will perhaps offset his name," she said.
She held the sword out to Cheyenne. Cheyenne gestured. Refusal.
"No. Your student. Your choice. Your responsibility."
Bashette took the scabbard from the wall and sheathed the sword. Then she turned and held it out to me.
"This is named Sesra."
"Sesra?" I asked, startled by the name. Wasn't that what Sim had called the break in the line of Eldventic verse? Was I being given a poet's sword?
"Sesra," she said softly, as if it were the name of God.
She stepped back, and I felt the weight of it settle back into my hands. Sensing something was expected of me, I drew it from its sheath. The faint ring of leather and metal seemed a whisper of its name.
Sesra.
It felt light in my hand. The blade was flawless. I slid it back into its sheath, and the sound was different. It sounded like the breaking of a line. It said, "Sesra." Cheyenne opened the inner door, and we left as we came, silently and with respect. The rest of the day was quite the opposite of exciting. With a dogged and humorless persistence, Vachette taught me how to care for my sword, how to clean and oil my sword, how to dismantle and reassemble my sword, how to strap the scabbard to my shoulder or hip, how the slightly enlarged guard would alter a few of the grips and motions of the K-10. The sword was not mine. The sword belonged to the school, to Ademre. I would return it when I was no longer able to fight. While I normally have little tolerance for hearing the same thing over and over again, I let Vachette ramble. The least I could do was let her repeat herself a bit when she was plainly anxious and trying to settle her mind. Around the 15th repetition, I asked what I should do if the sword broke. Not the hilt or the guard, but the blade itself. Should I still bring it back? Vachette gave me a look of dismay so raw it verged on horror. She didn't answer, and I made a point of not asking any more questions for the rest of the morning. After lunch, Vachette took me back to Magwin's cave. My teacher's mood seemed somewhat improved, but she was still far from her regular gregarious self.
"Magwin will be giving you Sesra's story," she said. "You must memorize it."
"Its story?" I asked. Vachette shrugged.
"In Ademic it is Atas. It is the history of your sword, everyone who has carried it, what they have done. It is something you must know."
We reached the top of the path and stood before Magwin's door. Vachette gave me a serious look.
"You must be on your best behavior and be very polite."
"I will," I said.
"Magwin is an important person, and you must attend closely to what she says."
"I will," I said. Vachette knocked on the door and escorted me in. Magwin sat at the same table as before. For all I could tell, she was copying the same book. She smiled when she saw Vachette, then noticed me and let her face slide into the familiar Adem impassivity.
"Magwin," Vashat said, profoundly polite entreaty. "This one needs the atas of his sword."
"Which sword did you find for him?"
Magwin asked, her face wrinkling even further as she squinted to see it.
"Sesra," Vashat said.
Magwin gave a laugh that was almost a cackle. She got down off her chair.
"I can't say I'm surprised," she said, and disappeared through a door that led back into the cliff.
Vashat let herself out, and I stood there feeling awkward, like one of those terrible dreams when you're on stage and can't remember what to say, or even what part you were meaning to play. Magwin returned, carrying a thick book bound in brown leather. At a gesture from her, we took seats in chairs facing each other. Hers was a deeply cushioned leather chair. Mine was not. I sat with Sesra across my knees, partly because it seemed appropriate, and partly because I was fond of the feel of it beneath my hand. She opened the book, the binding crackling as she spread it open on her lap. She flipped pages for a moment until she found the place she was looking for.
"First came Chael," she read, "who shaped me in fire for an unknown purpose. He carried me, then cast me aside."
Magwin looked up, unable to gesture as her hands were both occupied by the large book.
"Well?" she demanded.
"What would you like me to do?" I asked politely. I couldn't gesture due to my bandages. We made a fine pair of half-mutes.
"Repeat it back," she said, irritated. "You need to learn them all."
"First came Chael," I said, "who shaped me in fire for an unknown purpose. He carried me, then cast me aside." She nodded and continued.
"Next came Etane."
I repeated it. We continued this way for perhaps a half hour, owner after owner, name after name, loyalties declaimed and enemies killed. At first, the names and places were tantalizing. Then, as it continued, the list began to depress me, as nearly each piece ended with the death of the owner. They were not peaceful deaths either. Some died in wars, some in duels. Many were merely killed by or slain by, giving no clue as to the circumstances. After 30 of these, I had heard nothing resembling passed from this world peacefully in his sleep, surrounded by fat grandchildren. Then, the list stopped being depressing and became simply boring instead.
"Next came Finol of the clear and shining eye," I repeated attentively. "Much beloved of Dulcin. She herself slew 2 Daruna, then was killed by Gremin at the Drossen Tor."
I cleared my throat before Magwin could recite another passage.
"If I may ask," I said, "how many have carried Sesra over the years?"
"Sesra," she corrected me sharply. "Do not presume to meddle with her name. It means to break, to catch, and to fly."
I looked down at the sheathed sword across my lap. I felt the weight of it, the chill of the metal under my fingers. A small sliver of the smooth gray blade was visible above the top of the sheath. "How can I say this so you can understand?" Sesra was a fine name. It was thin and bright and dangerous. It fit the sword like a glove fits a hand. But it wasn't the perfect name. This sword's name was Sesra. This sword was the jarring break in a line of perfect verse. It was the broken breath. It was smooth and swift and sharp and deadly. The name didn't fit it like a glove. It fit like skin. More than that, it was bone and muscle and movement. Those things are the hand, and Sesra was the sword. It was both the name and the thing itself. I can't tell you how I knew this, but I knew it. Besides, if I was to be a namer, I decided I could damn well choose the name of my own sword. I looked up at Magwin.
It is a good name, I agreed politely, deciding to keep my opinion to myself until I was well gone from Ademre. I am only wondering how many owners there have been entirely. That is something I should know as well. Magwin gave me a sour look that said she knew I was patronizing her, but she flipped ahead several pages in her book. Then a few more. Then a few more.
236, she said. You will be the 237th.
She flipped back to the beginning of the list.
Let us begin again.
She drew a breath and said,
First came Chael, who shaped me in fire for an unknown purpose. He carried me, then cast me aside.
I fought down the urge to sigh. Even with my trooper's knack for learning lines, it would take long, weary days setting them all to memory. Then I realized what this truly meant. If each owner had kept Sasura for 10 years, and it had never sat idle for longer than a day or two, that meant Sasura was, at a very conservative estimate, more than 2,000 years old. I received my next surprise 3 hours later when I tried to excuse myself for supper. As I stood to leave, Magwin explained I was to remain with her until I learned all of Sasura's story by heart. Someone would bring us our meals, and there was a room nearby where I could sleep. First came Chael.